This is The Thirsty Developer, episode number 45, for Monday, December 22nd, 2008. What's new in Team System 2010? This week we have an interview with Mario Rodriguez, a program manager on the Team Foundation Server product group. We talk about some of the cool new features coming up in Visual Studio Team System 2010. Let's listen in. Hi, this is Larry Clarkin, and I'm recording this podcast at the Microsoft office in Downers Grove, Illinois. We've run into our old friend, Mario Rodriguez.
Hello.
Mario, can you say hello to everybody?
Hello, guys. How are you guys doing?
Mario, what do you do for Microsoft?
I'm a program manager in Team Foundation Server, and specifically, I did a lot of things in version control in the TFS 2008, and in TFS 2010, I've been specializing mainly on the TFS architecture, the server architecture, and making sure that we have a good framework going forward to be able to host that product on the cloud. So I'm a program manager, design features, gather requirements, visit customers. That's my life, and I love it.
And we're going to ask you a lot of questions about kind of the new features in Visual Studio 2010, which was just announced a few weeks ago at the PDC. I'm actually joined by a special co-host this week. Angela, can you say hi to everybody? Tell everybody what you do.
Sure. Thanks, Larry. So this is Angela Binkowski. I am the district's developer technical specialist. So I'm part of the evangelism team with Larry, and my job is to get out there and teach all the developers and testers and program managers why Team System is so awesome and show them what it can do.
And one of the things that you do as part of your job is you're like the direct conduit for our customers and our community to what features should be in new versions of, you know, Visual Studio Team System. And that's why you work so closely with Mario. Now, Mario, you're not actually from the area. We're in, you know, the Chicago suburbs today. You're actually from the North Carolina development team, right?
Correct. I'm based right now in the Raleigh office in the RTP region with Brian Harry, and out of that office, we actually do version control. We also do the initial framework of the architecture. We do administration, and we also do team build. There's also Ed Glass's team also is over there, and they do a lot of things with load testing as well.
Yeah, and we had Ed Glass on the show, I think, about 15 or 16 episodes ago. So
we'll
put a link in the show notes back to Ed's. Ed was a fun interview because we caught up with him at the QAI conference, and I convinced him, you know, using my Jedi mind trick to talk about features that weren't quite yet announced yet, and it was kind of cool. I put the disclaimer on, you know, what we could talk about and what we couldn't.
Perfect.
But Angela, over the last couple of days, has, you know, brought you around to several customers, you know, in the area to, you know, for you to tell them about, you know, new features and what's coming up in Visual Studio 2010, and also to get, you know, their feedback on what, you know, what they would like to see in the product, you know, both in the 2010 time frame and more importantly going forward. So can you share, you know, with the audience here, what are, you know, some of the best features of 2010? What are the things that people should be looking for?
Correct. Before I do that, so you're right, I came here with Angela. We have a program within Team Foundation Server specifically where we actually assign program managers to different regions of the United States, and then we just go to work with that DTS contact and actually visiting customers. And what we really want to do at that point is build some type of relationship, also make sure that we help them out and close any deals while we're over here, and learn a lot about our customers. And as part of that learning experience, we usually have to give something out to them for their time, and we talk about VS 2010. So in Visual Studio 2010, there's mainly two pillars from a VSTS perspective. There's a testing pillar, and there's also a business alignment pillar. The first one is really focused on the manual tester and actually test from the beginning to the end. Over there, you're going to find things like our new manual tester, all brand new in WPF. It's codenamed right now Kamano. You're also going to find features that have to do a lot with the integration of the test edition with TFS. So now a test is just a work item in Team Foundation Server. And you're also going to find out features that have to do with recording and recording and test passes and managing all that type of infrastructure.
So in the last few days, as I've been traveling with Mario, I've seen some really amazing things. You know, of course, some of this stuff you get to see at PDC or if you download the videos, but seeing it live is always better. And a couple of things that he showed were particularly cool. The one thing that you keep hearing people say is no repro. You know, we want to absolutely get to a point where you will never have a developer saying, I can't fix this bug because there's no way for me to reproduce it. And I saw a couple of things that were really cool that I think will go a long way towards solving that problem. So, Mario, if you could kind of go into a little more detail about why there's going to be no more repro problems.
Exactly, definitely. So what we're doing essentially is we're replaying back camera Skinner talking from PDC. That's essentially what we're doing. We are queued at 10 minutes and 20 seconds if you actually want to see it since the beginning. And we replay that back. We pause at times and then explain to the user. The no repro is really based on three core things. Number one is whenever a tester is actually executing any type of manual test, we're going to be recording a video of what he's actually doing. Once we record that video, we're actually going to put indexes in the bug for the exact step that he took. So if I just want to jump to the place that where the actual defect happened, I could just do it from workout and tracking. So that's part number one is give you visual evidence that the bug actually existed, where developers sometimes are very skittish on that sense and says, that never happened. So that's number one. Number two has to do with the integration of the system information. Not only are we going to give you a way to get a video, we're also going to tell you what build that system was at and all the data of that system. And number three, and this is the most powerful thing, is the whole thing about the Proteus, which was the code name before. Now it's just named historical debugging. And this is the ability to actually gather all the information in the log and be able to replay it back in the debugger of Visual Studio real time, just like if the application was standing.
So on the system information, are you gathering information not just about the application under test, but actually about what's going on in the computer? Because I could tell you, Mario, I write no bugs. Every one of the problems with anything that I've written is caused by some device driver, you know, way down in the kernel level.
Definitely. Yeah, me too. And those things are very, very hard to actually get. But we get some information about the system. We don't go very deep. So we get how much RAM was allocated. We get a little bit more information, maybe about some device information, but we don't go and get a snapshot of all of the device drivers and what is the configuration of that. We get a high-level information. That would be something, actually, that I could try to see if I talk to the team and try to see how much we could leverage that.
Yeah, because that would solve every, you know, bug that I've ever had in one of my applications.
Definitely.
You know, so tell us a little bit about the historical debugging, because that sounds kind of cool. Because normally, I have to, you know, if I'm a developer and I get the steps to reproduce, which are generally manual, and oftentimes error prone. You know, they'll miss something that's going on, like, you know, they opened this other customer in the background, something like that. Normally, you know, to step through something, I have to reproduce it, catch the error, you know, in my debugger, and then I can step through and get the full richness. But it sounds like, you know, you can almost go, you know, pull up what they actually did and debug it.
Correct.
In the IDE?
Yes, correct. This is in the IDE. Essentially, what we do is we are able to instrument the build in a way that we could inject things within it, so to be able to get variable information. And at the when the tester is actually going through his test cases, he could go and say, save a log of this. And essentially, we're compiling all of this rich data, put it in a file, compressing it so it becomes really small. And then once you open that, it just opens in the debugger window in VS. And now you go from the beginning of that application all the way to where the code actually fail even. Even if there's no code failure, you could go to the point that he actually did the save on and look at all the variables in that time frame as well. So you just imagine.
So I get my locals window and everything?
You get your locals windows and everything, your watch. You could actually move the instruction pointer if you want.
So I just got to pause and say, cool.
It is freaking amazing, exactly. And the thing that people should understand on this as well is that the overhead that we've been able to get is, I think it's between 10 and 20% or even less than that. So it doesn't put that much overhead on your application. And the future is really, really, really promising for us. I mean, in my opinion, this is going to be the next Watson that takes it to an extra level for people that are actually using our stack.
So that's one thing to consider is that the tester will need a little bit more you know, system resources, but 10 to 20% doesn't sound like an obnoxious amount of system resources.
Correct. And I don't know the latest numbers, but I know our goal, I think, is to ship it with very, very low overhead on that application. You know, and again, it's a CTP right now, so we'll continue to improve it. But the future looks really, really promising for that node repro. So just to finish that, you know, the real trick now is you get a video, you get all of the steps. You also get this historical debugging. So essentially, you have no way of not reproing the not reproing the bug.
Well, that's very cool. I've actually seen that in action, and that truly, that just made me have to stop and kind of watch in awe. So something else I was thinking about, since you know we've kind of been talking about, you know, catching bugs when they've gone to the tester. So one thing that I know that I saw a couple of times when I'd gone out to North Carolina, got kind of a preview, was something you guys are using internally, which is a really cool concept that I've actually had a couple of customers ask me about. So, you know, there's this whole idea of continuous integration in 2008, being able to test your applications. But what about the idea that I might want to run a set of tests before I actually commit the change? So I don't want to get to a point where I actually break my build. And I know there's something really cool coming in 2010 that's going to address that. So if you could talk a little bit about that, that'd be great.
Yes, that's correct. And that feature, we actually call it gated check-in. Internally, it's mainly known as Gauntlet. But if you are familiar with our friends from Borderland, they actually have a product called Gauntlet right now.
Okay, so I hear Gauntlet and I think of the video game from the 80s.
Oh,
you know,
yes.
So,
yes.
You know,
I like that game, actually.
So. It was a cool game, so.
But it's not like that. Essentially, we call it gated check-in now in the UI. And what it allows you to do is whenever you go on as a developer and check-in, if gated check-in is enabled for any of those paths or those solutions, then what we do is we create a shelf set. And you're familiar with what a shelf set is. We create a shelf set. We put that in the system. And the build system, then essentially what it does is it syncs the workspace just like it did before. But now it gets the shelf set and applies it to that workspace and then executes a set of test cases. If those test cases fail, then essentially what it does is it rejects the check-in and it tells the developer back in the pending changes, you know what, this failed and this is why. It's, again, you get it through the builds window essentially, but if all of the all of the tests pass, then it successfully checks in. So it just goes and checks in that shelf set, and then it checks it in behalf of the user too, so you don't lose none of that type of functionality. So it's not like every build is going to show up as, oh my god, it got checked in by the build system. It would actually say who it came from. And there's a queue that gets actually built on that. So if there's five developers checking in, you have a queue of five gated check-ins on that, and they'll build on each other. So the feature, though, we need to probably do a little bit better job explaining to our customers at the end, because although it is very powerful, it can slow down your development process. So we want to probably explain to our customers that they should only use the feature when they want to actually have a little bit more a way to actually control the stability of that build in a greater degree. CI works perfect for teams that when they're doing constant development, because as soon as it breaks, they could fix it within 3 seconds, right? But in gated check-in, if you're getting near to your product release, you cannot afford that type of downtime. So that's probably when they will use it.
Yeah, and I'll tie it to an analogy, is that I used to work with a developer who was very good about commenting his check-ins. Right, this guy would actually write, you know, very good, you know, descriptions of everything that he had changed. Right, and he actually spent a lot of time in it. And it's interesting that the minute that we started enforcing comments on check-in, his ability to do that just absolutely ceased, because every once in a while he'd want to check in something just to see if it would work in the CI build. And you know, he was annoyed by the comment box, so he would actually put a very an expletive in there. He met the requirements, and it sounds like that would be the same thing with gated check-ins. That you know, when you're in that hurry, that churn phase, which is part of the project, part of the development, that you don't want to be bothered with it. But you know, when the applications, you know, got real stability, and there's some real
Correct.
Concern about that. Particularly, I guess if you were doing a bug fix on a released application, you would want to make sure that you had a gated check-in, because
exactly.
This is a hot fix.
That's a good that's a good analogy there. If you are in production and you're making a fix in production, you probably won't get it shaken at that point. You want to make sure that whatever you're shaking into that is it has very good quality prior to even checking that code in. So you're right. Anything that is on QA or maybe in production, you would do that. Or when you're locking down the project as well, you would enable this gated checking ability.
So two quick questions, and I can't think that I'm the first person that's ever asked about these. On the gated check-in, can I do it by, you know, user or role, you know, in the system? So I could say that my junior developers are required to go through gated check-in, but maybe my senior architect's not?
No, that functionality is not in the 2010 release.
It's on or off. Okay.
It's on or off for a specific think build definition. And that's the way that it gets enabled right now. It's at a build definition level. You say, I want to enable gated check-in for this. And it would only apply then to a set to the set of mappings that you have for that build definition. There's nothing user-based that controls it. Although, you know, we definitely talked about that within our team. It's just the complexity of implementing that we couldn't essentially fit with.
Yeah, with the internals of TFS, you know. The other question I had is that, you know, I guess it's related to a build that pretty much answers the question that I can associate a set of tests with it. So I may not want to run every unit test as part of the gated check-in, but I may want to just run, you know, a subset of them that are the critical, you know, tests, right?
That's right. So since it's associated with a build definition, anything you could do at a build definition level, that's your UB. So right now, it's integrated with workflow, so you could go and say, yes, as part of this build definition, go and actually execute this set of test cases, and as part of this build definition, go and do this other logic after. So gated check-in is enabled at the build definition level. It's not at the source control level, but at the build definition level.
So one last thing I definitely wanted to cover, which it seems very appropriate since we're actually sitting in a room where a large group of architects are about to meet, is that there was one more section that we've been showing off to customers today, which literally made me want to stand on my chair and applaud. It was so awesome. So as someone who had spent a couple of years as an enterprise architect on applications, and, you know, Visio and the whiteboard were my tools, and you know, you could generate code, and then you had to have all these meetings to make sure everything was up to sync, and you'd have to do all these code reviews to make sure people were following, you know, the architecture that you had laid out. There are just some really amazing tools coming out in the next version that I think will make a lot of architects out there very happy. And it will also make the team in general much happier, because it kind of goes again towards the finding errors earlier and finding problems in your architecture earlier. So if you could kind of give a quick synopsis of just a couple of the new architect tools that are coming out that are just awesome.
Yeah, you're right. We've been demoing this now for 6 customers, and every single one of them has loved it. And some of them have almost got out of their seat while we've actually been doing it, or they look around to their peers and go, look at that. How cool was that? So, yes, I think, you know, the architecture team has an incredible job on these features that they have designed. And even when Cameron actually demoed it in PDC, he got, you know, standing an outstanding reception, a lot of applauses. And whenever Brian Harry actually demos it too, he gets a pretty good reception. He loves the new stuff too, by the way, him being an architect and everything too. But yes, it's composed of 3 things mainly. The first thing is what they call a layer diagram. And essentially what that allows you to do is, as an architect, you could go and say, this is what I think my application should be doing or should be designed architecturally. You essentially draw these boxes and you set dependencies between them. Between these layers. And I call it boxes because once you see it rendered as an image, it's essentially a set of boxes with links between them. And then after you do that, you could grab your source code and start dropping them into these boxes to try to say, okay, this is what I think these classes and these namespaces and this project files should be doing within this architecture diagram. And then after that, the coolest thing is they could then validate it. You could go and ask the build system, go ahead and try to see if this is actually doing what I think it should be doing. The coolest part about this, again, is that you could do it after the fact. You don't actually have to build this and then do it all your code. You could actually do this layer diagram on an application that has been on the, you know, on production now for 3 years, if you even want to try to understand how far you are from your architecture vision.
So this isn't a feature that's just, you know, file new, only works on new projects.
Correct.
If you had migrated a project from, say, 2005 to 2008, and when you pull into 2010, you could say, hey, I can take advantage of this tool. primarily to do some of the validation stuff and also to give you a good visualization.
Correct. And what it helps you, it's not only visualize it and validate it, is a lot of times you think that an application behaves one way. You make assumptions in the architecture, essentially, is what you do. And what ends up happening is an assumption gets violated and the whole, you know, another part of the product just falls down flat. You get this SEV1, PRI1 bugs just because you violated one tiny assumption in one place. Well, this allows you to catch that prior to even check in. We could even generate a code, a checking policy. So you catch this at the point that it was being written. And that's incredibly, incredibly powerful for the architects and for the teams. If you look at how much time teams sometimes waste in actually making architectural changes because they have right now spaghetti code across it, you kind of are getting rid of that. If you don't get rid of it, essentially what you do is you at least realize it and you understand what are the changes you need to make. So this enables you to have very, very well organized structure going forward.
Yeah, people don't understand the ripple effect of an application. And I remember, you know, when I had the moment of clarity about this, there was a private method on a class, you know, so totally internal to this, you know, using OO principles. It was completely hidden. It's something that, you know, as long as you don't break the interface, and as long as you turn a set of valid results, you know, you should be able to change that. Broke the entire system. I mean, there was like bombs going off in the background.
Yep.
And by the way, that's actually the change. I'll never forget this, that led us to continuous integration. Because we've been reading about continuous integration. This is prior to, you know, Team Foundation Server shipping.
Got it.
But, you know, it's like, well, we thought, okay, now this is how we should start catching this thing, is not not when we push it out to servers and everything starts blowing sky high.
Exactly.
And, of course, this was an enterprise library that was used by 50 applications. So literally, you know, it's kind of cool.
Core library.
Yeah, because every server lit red, you know.
Yep. So. Exactly. So the second thing that the architecture's key also has is what they call, you're able to visualize dependencies. And you could visualize dependencies by assemblies, dependencies by namespaces, and I think the last one is classes or something like that. I'm forgetting the name of the last one. And that is also extremely powerful. There's three main use cases of that. One is, if I'm a new developer coming into an actual team, now I don't have to dig through 20,000 spec documents that are probably not even updated into essentially of what they do. I could just go and say, you know what, allow me to visualize all of the dependencies between these namespaces. And when that happens, I'm able to understand how I should be using these methods, how I should be using the application and coding against it. That's number one. The second thing that allows you to do is visualize dependencies. And find cyclical dependencies between your namespaces or any type of things that you're thinking that, you know, someone calling someone that they shouldn't be calling in reality because you think there's another performant kind of path to pass through. So it allows you to actually see where your holes are, where are you actually putting the majority of your logic within your application, maybe some dead code that you have because it's not getting called by anyone as well. So that's another thing that is extremely powerful.
Oh, so that's cool because, you know, if you have a class that's not being called or a method that's not being called, it shouldn't have any lines in the visual dependency.
Correct.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people would be surprised if they actually saw the tool in their code. You almost want to play a game with them that says, guess what is the thing with the most dependency in your application, and I bet you most people have it wrong.
Exactly. I agree with you. And the last thing is the sequence diagram. Just be able to just get a CS file and say, just build me a sequence diagram of this. I mean, that is incredibly cool.
Wait, I think we need to repeat that because I don't think people really get how cool that is. Yeah. So one more time?
Okay, one more time is you get a CS file, you right-click on it and say, show me a sequence diagram of this. It's probably not right-click, but you have to go to a method or some gesture and you say, show me a sequence diagram of this. And what that allows you to do, I mean, think about it before. Before you had to build a visual diagram first, then try to kind of map it to what you actually are coding. And then by the fifth bug fix, that visual diagram is essentially on the floor. It's no longer true. It doesn't behave like that at all. Well, now, you know what? You never have to keep these things in sync.
I have one quick clarification, though. You said CS file works for VB too, right?
Yes, it works actually. Yeah,
we have a lot of listeners that if we say something, you know, like C#, you know, the first thing that'll happen is it works for VB, and you know, both of them are first class languages,
yeah,
you know, so
exactly.
It'll work just fine. Well, Mario, so what's your favorite feature of 2010? just to wrap up.
My favorite. I love the layer diagram and the what you could actually do with this. That is a killer, killer, killer feature. That's one.
The PM for source control is pointing to somebody else's tool.
I think they did a great job with that. I mean, historical debugging is something else that is incredibly powerful as well for our customers. Everything on the test queue is also very, very good. I mean, I believe in our pillar in VS 2010. It's all about tests. It's all about business alignment as well. And now we have this whole thing of architecture that delivers incredible value to our customers. If you ask me about my favorite feature of actually TFS, I will tell you visualizing change. I mean, that's what I worked on, branch visualization and tracking changes. It's a lot of innovation in that. No competitor has it today in the marketplace, so you cannot point to a single system that actually could do what we do today and in the short amount of time that we actually develop it as well. So from my product, it would be whatever I'm working on.
And what's the common use case for branch visualization?
Branch visualization and tracking changes, to be more exact on that, is imagine I actually have made a bug fix, right? And I want to understand where is that bug fix across all of these branches. So I made a bug fix in this feature crew. Has this other branch over here in my other lab actually has this fix? Does my main actually have the fix as well? Does my production branch have the fix? Well, before to be able to do that, you will need to go to each one of these branches, right-click on them, do a kind of file compare across all of them. I mean, it will take you a long, long time. Now all you have to do is say track change, select the branches. Within less than 20 seconds, you get your results.
Excellent. That's really cool.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things is that I don't think we've talked much about branching on the show at this point. I think we've mentioned it a couple times here and there. But that's really, you know, that's kind of like the next step of maturity, you know, for a product team. You know, if I always tell people, start with unit testing. If you really want to improve the quality of your code, unit testing, then continuous integration. Once you nail those two, branching is the next logical step, and it sounds like the tools are getting better for that.
Yeah, the tools are now first-class citizens, and actually, in my opinion, right now, we're probably best of breed and when it comes to what we could do with branch and merge and the innovation that we actually have put in the product, specifically in TFS on those feature sets.
Well, Mario, I want to thank you for coming on the show. I know you've got to run off. You got yet another event, and
yes.
we're running you ragged all over, you know, Illinois, Wisconsin. Did we get him to Indiana or no?
No.
Next time, though. Yeah. Well, again, thanks for coming on the show, and we hope to see you again soon.
Thank you for having me. It was a blast. Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to The Thirsty Developer. This podcast is available on the Zune Marketplace and the iTunes Music Store. You can also find a link to the feed at thirstydeveloper.com. For general comments on the show or to suggest a topic, send an email to thirstydeveloper@live.com.